man. This is nuts.
This is where they, if they hire, they have to do something.
Like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Portland's better than that. Where is it?
Today's the 25th.
March 25th, we're going to start out with some public hearings. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3025 and concurrently House Bill 3097. Jan, can you give us a brief description of the two bills?
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. 3025 establishes an unlawful employment practice related to the misuse of information about criminal charges and convictions of applicants for employment, creates a right of civil action for violations, declares an emergency. House Bill 3097 makes inquiring about the applicant's conviction history and certain activities related to conducting a criminal records check on prospective employee an unlawful employment practice. There is a proposed dash one amendment submitted by the sponsor, Representative Bence, that really for all intents and purposes deletes the language in the bill and simply states that it is an unlawful employment practice to use job application forms that inquire into the applicant's conviction history.
Thank you. So we have a couple of representatives that want to testify, so I think we'll go ahead and bring them up. Representative Bence and Representative Peluso. And you can just comment on which bill you're giving testimony for, if you want to address both. You can do that as well.
Go ahead, Mel.
Good morning, Chair Holby and members of the House and Business Labor Committee. I am here to testify on the Ban the Box. 3025. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the representative from House District 50, which is Gresham and a small part of Portland. I am here to speak again in support of HB 3025. As many of you know, I worked in law enforcement for 30 years with the Gresham Police Department. I started in 1979 and was promoted through every rank, spending my last year as Gresham's chief of police. I have always balanced my law enforcement career by being heavily involved in nonprofit work centered on reducing homelessness and poverty. With my experience, I have seen firsthand the devastation that recidivism has on individuals, families, and communities. It isn't pretty. While many think of law enforcement as crime response or serving justice, an often overlooked goal is to prevent future crime. If an individual serves their time and takes steps to turn their life around, we need to ensure that the system is set up to support these positive steps away from criminal behavior. Far too many, including the approximately 32,000 people currently under the Department of Corrections control, the ability to even interview for a job is inhibited by that little box on job applications. When people with prior convictions and arrests are continually denied the opportunity to even interview for employment, let alone be offered a job, we are instead pushing them back towards their past criminal life. It is important to note the single most effective deterrent against reoffending is employment. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I urge you all to support House Bill 3025. This bill is the best choice to make sure all of our constituents have a fair chance at being able to make it to an interview and, if successful, a job and a real shot at a stable future. House Bill 3025 ensures that our justice system can keep its promise of a second chance for those who have served their time. Thank you for your time on this important issue.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Cliff Bence, District 60, testifying in support of the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 3097. I brought this bill in response to a request from a constituent whose children unfortunately have criminal records and are having enormous difficulty in finding employment. I balance, of course, the burden that we place upon business on the one hand and then the benefit that we're trying to actually give business by having more people employed and lower taxes that go with putting people in prison that choose to reoffend. It seems to me that banning the box is a very modest investment when it comes to business. I will say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that I think this debate is off point a bit. I mean, I'm here to support banning the box on job applications. But from my own experience in our law firm, we employ between 12 and 25 people, depending. It seems that people's background are known almost instantly through the internet. And so banning stuff on job applications seems to me to be a forlorn hope, even though I'm suggesting it in my Dash 1 amendment. I believe the focus would be better placed on incenting businesses to try to employ people who have these challenging backgrounds. And how we might do that is really the question. It's a burden that all society should bear, not just business, and so we should be talking in that vein. I'm guessing that you will be, in fact, addressing that issue. I spent quite a bit of time looking at how one pays one debt to society and trying to figure out how we could go to employers and say, hey, this person needs another chance, deserves another chance, has paid their debt, and it's time for us to do something to try to help them get back on the employment track and be a productive member of society. The emphasis is on the we. Who is it that we're placing that burden upon? And so there's the challenge. And I know you will be debating that today. I think my little Dash 1 amendment is a step in the right direction. I think to go further, as my bill, as was crafted by LC, is placing too much of a burden on business in response to the need. I think there's a better way of doing it. That's why my Dash 1 amendment has been proposed. But I'm very happy your committee is looking into this. It deserves attention, and I'm sure you're going to give it what it's due. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and introducing the two measures before us this morning. Don't know if there's any questions for you at this point. So, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Representative Bentz, as far as offering an incentive rather than the state dictating, you know, this is how you should go about hiring people, especially when they're not willing to bear the liability for whatever happens should you choose to hire someone like that. And I was thinking, Representative Peluso, you know, in your role as a police chief, you had to hire people, you know, for as police officers, you know, and a thorough background check, because you want people that are responsible to you that you can trust. And any business owner wants the same thing. And so to say businesses, you need to basically overlook this to hire someone, you know, seems like a little bit of a conflict. And then I would say also, as an employer, and we went through this very recently with someone who had a felony, and we didn't do a background check, but it came after the fact, and she still works for me. But it's much better, I think, if someone was applying for a job to just come right out and say, just like a recovering alcoholic, I have this issue. And for me, as an employer, I would take a look at that and give them a high marks for that. So I think this comes through the back door almost in a wrong way, saying we want to hide this at first, and then maybe it'll come out later. But I think it's much better to bring these things out first and then proceed.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'm an individual that has hired people with felons on the record. In fact, they told me that up front in a town hall meeting I had. This lady said that she couldn't find a job because she was a convicted felon. And so I had her come to our organization. We ended up hiring her to be a telephone to work on solicitation of funds for nonprofits, and she was horrible at it, just horrible, and she knew it, so she quit. But we brought her back later when we found a slot for her that she could fit into, and she's a very good employee. But the thing that impressed me the most, she told me up front, I'm a convicted felon, so therefore that's what we did. It didn't have anything to do with the work that we did. And I think that that's fine if you can do that, but I struggle with the government coming in and telling people what they need to do and how they need to hire. That's where I come from on it, because it's up to me as an employer, not the government.
Sure. Hovey, may I respond?
Certainly.
Representative Barreto, Representative Esquivel, the way I see it, this doesn't restrict any of what you're suggesting. This just allows... It is literally a box that will disappear off a form. It doesn't restrict anybody from asking those questions, from doing a... I mean, I would encourage everyone to do a thorough background on whoever they employ. But this does not eliminate any of those options for people to ask those questions and to do that background. It just allows somebody an opportunity to take that first step in the door to have that opportunity to even be backgrounded.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hovey. If I could, I just, for everybody in the room, that as these ideas have been coming forward, I support the effort to try and make employment easier for folks that were trying to get back into the system. I voiced my concerns to folks that have come through the office, but I do want to be very clear that the way it was sold to me actually looks more like Representative Bence's language than the 3025. So I'm trying to sort this out in my mind. I thought that was the intent, and this other bill, again, good intentions. I have a few more questions about just laying that out there.
Yeah, thank you. And we aren't moving this particular bill today, so there will be more conversation. I have a very long list of people that want to testify. I want to make sure the public gets a chance to testify. Representative Wagner.
Mr. Chair, do we have Bully or LC coming in to testify today?
No.
And I might have a question for the sponsor of the bill, if that's all right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Representative, I guess my question on this, and I don't know if you talked with LC on it, but could this be basically an elevated class for someone with criminal conviction or put employers in a bad situation where Bully has to police this if somebody says they didn't hire me because I had this or they didn't ask me about my background?
I don't think so. I don't know for certain, but I'm happy to do some follow-up and find out.
Because I'm just kind of curious if we're creating a new protected class here.
Again, I don't believe so, but I can, like I say, I will do some follow-up to check with Bully and see.
Thank you. Appreciate your time this morning and getting us started.
Thank you.
up next, forgive me if I butcher your names. Ty Bo. That was probably way off. Emmanuel Price and London Elliott. Good morning. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and we're trying to keep our testimony to about 3 minutes.
Okay. Hi, Chairman Hovey and the committee members. My name is T. Vu, and I am a full-time student at Portland Community College. I am also a full-time employed member of Society Today, and I would have to say that my greatest achievement up to this date is being named the world's greatest uncle by my niece and nephew. But, you know, I balance my passion for art and my passion for helping others. It doesn't always work this way, but in the end, it's not up to me, and sometimes most of the time it's up to a power greater than myself. But this wasn't always the case, though, as in the past, my being able to be gainfully employed was hampered by many things. The most important and significant one being my past felony record and the box that read, "Have you ever been convicted of a felony?" When I would answer truthfully, I would always be denied an interview. When I would lie and get the interview, most times I would get the job. Unfortunately, I was always a hard worker. I would get promotions, and eventually I would have to get the background check in order to advance further. My felonies would be found out, and I would be terminated. My employers always said that they regretted having to do this, but it was company policy. And so when I would ask them if they would have even interviewed me, having marked the box, they would answer no. So when the campaign came for Ban the Box, I saw this as a solution. not only for myself, but for many others that will come after me searching for a chance to fit back in and participate in society. Banning the box will allow someone such as myself the opportunity to get into the interview and present myself as how I am today, not how I was. It will also allow my potential employers the opportunity to weigh my worthiness based on my present self rather than my past self. And so what I'm doing here today is to ask you to support Ban the Box, to vote your approval for the fair chance, and to allow women and men like myself a chance to prove ourselves worthy based on our actions today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is London Elliott. My name is London Elliott, and I am a senior at Jefferson High School in Portland. And also an emerging leader with the Urban League of Portland's Social Justice and Civic Leadership Program. I'm speaking on House Ballot 3025. I urge you to support the Fair Chance for All Ban the Box initiative because I believe it could help families like mine. I've seen firsthand the problem that people who have prior arrests or convictions have finding a job when they come back to wider society. I've seen my grandma struggle with finding a job that would help her support her family as a single mother. I've seen how stressful it is and how hard she has worked to put food on the table, to keep the water on and the lights running, to keep a roof over her and her five children's heads. Currently, my older brother is in jail, and we have to worry if he'll ever be able to get a job because he did something stupid when he was 15 years old. Once he gets out, he'll be expected to be a member of our society, which means getting a job. I have a cousin who is now an award-winning author, but wouldn't have this chance if no one gave him a chance. If they looked at his prior jail time instead of his abilities, he wouldn't be where he is today, and everybody reads author. Who knows what my brother could be when he gets out of jail? Without passing Ban the Box, he'll be another person in our economy struggling for a job. Thank you for your time, and I really hope you vote to give a fair chance to all people.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Really appreciate you coming down to give us your thoughts.
It's spring break, so
thank you.
During spring break.
Odd thing to do on spring break, but admirable.
Thank you.
Got to spend your time doing something.
Representative Gallegos, I see you. Are you wishing to testify on this bill?
I am.
Go ahead and come on up. Thank you very much. To be fair, I'm limiting people to 3 minutes.
And as a rep, I get 1.5.
You'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, Joseph Gallegos, Representative House District 30, which is the economic engine of the state, lovely Hillsboro. Thank you, Committee Chair Hovey, Vice Chair Barton, and Vice Chair Kennemer, who is not here, but thank you anyway. Committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to stand up for this bill. Basically, I mean, as an educator, you know, I've had to work with young people who are striving. I mean, actually literally had students who had been convicted of felonies and so on, but were getting a second chance, and I think that literally is the American way, is to give people a second chance, and that's what this bill is about. It's also, for me, about removing barriers, providing opportunities, and as I said, as an educator, that's what I've been all about all my life. This will give... really give employers an opportunity to see their potential employees, and without this opportunity, employers might actually miss out on the best possible person for that job. So for those reasons, I'm really very supportive of this bill, and could answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. We're limiting questions.
Yeah, 3 minutes, right.
I don't see any questions for you. I do appreciate you coming
sure,
down.
Sure, you bet. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I previously called Emmanuel Price, who didn't testify, so I assume he's not here. Is it Jim Hauser, mm-hmm. Eric Richardson, and Patrick... Dick Gehring. Good morning. If you would introduce yourself before you give your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jim Hauser, and my wife and I own and have operated Hawthorne Auto Clinic at 4307 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland for 32 years. I'm also co-chair of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, a network of over 2,500 Oregon small business owners working together to lift up the real voices of small business on public policy. I and the Main Street Alliance of Oregon strongly support HB 3025. 28 years ago, I hired an employee who, as it turns out, had a long ago very serious criminal history. He recently retired after nearly three decades as one of my best employees. Having a criminal record doesn't mean being a bad employee. In my experience, people with criminal records are often model employees. They are frequently the most dedicated and conscientious. A lot of doors are shut to them, so when someone gives them an opportunity, they make the most of it. Postponing a criminal background check or asking a candidate questions about arrest or conviction records unrelated to job duties until after the job offer has been made gives an employer the opportunity to appreciate that the best person for the job may in fact have a record. Employers may actually learn that the company policies requiring early background investigations are not in the best interest of either the company or the applicant. From my perspective, why would an employer want to short-circuit the hiring process and deny themselves the opportunity to hire the best person for the job? That is why our company has long ago removed from our job application all extraneous questions unrelated to job performance, including a criminal record. In the end, the government cannot always be expected to alone solve every community-based problem. Since the task of successfully integrating former offenders back into the society relies heavily on obtaining steady employment, employers who care about the communities that support them are going to have to step forward to do their part. Delaying criminal background questions or investigations until after the best person for the job has been determined provides an employer with the maximum workforce potential at minimal investment in time or inconvenience. Over the years, I've learned that what's good for my community is good for my business. As a small business owner, I know that when people have opportunities to succeed, the local community and the economy thrives, and in turn, my company thrives. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead if you'd like to testify. Introduce yourself for the record.
I'll go next, I guess. Chair and committee members, my name is Eric Richardson, and I am a father, a husband, and I'm also the president of the Eugene Springfield NAACP. I'm here in support of HB 3025. It makes sense economically, and it supports the idea of rehabilitation and second chances. The mission of the NAACP is to ensure the political, educational, social, economic equality of rights of all persons and to eliminate race-based discrimination. The last two points are of utmost importance when considering this bill. To restate, we hope to ensure the economic equality of all persons and to eliminate race-based discrimination. For far too long, racism and judicial discrimination has been a common occurrence in the African American community. Decades of unjust or at least unbalanced decisions have seen generations victimized because of their racial and economic status. And this has created a revolving door of poverty and dashed dreams. The black unemployment rate is consistently double that of the general population. If folks were being hired, would that number be as high? In the last decade, we have seen 12 states adopt this concept of banning the box with great success. We here in Oregon have shown the nation we care about the average person by passing the voter bill. But we let Memphis, Tennessee beat us to banning the box. It's time we ban the box in Oregon. In a state with noted disproportionate minority contacts, with a 2% African American population in which 11% of the prison population is African American, this bill would be a great benefit for the African American community. in order to give individuals a second chance and to reduce the cases of recidivism, HB 3025 calls for a concrete way to mitigate this obvious drain on the potential of this population to contribute positively to our state. In other areas of the country where Ban the Box has taken effect, there has been a dramatic increase in hires for people with prior convictions. In one case, moving from a 6% hire rate to over 6%. Please join me in supporting House Bill 3025, banning the box and giving a second chance for those who would work to better themselves, their families, and in extension, their communities.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. I'm Patrick Gehring, Director of Adult Workforce Services at Work Systems, Inc. We oversee and coordinate the workforce system serving the Portland metro area. Last year, WorkSource Portland Metro served over 100,000 job seekers through our five WorkSource centers. About 9% or more than 9,000 people self-disclosed having a criminal background. 60% of those are male and 34% of those are people of color. To meet the need, we provide an array of services including job clubs for ex-offenders, workshops to help communicate with employers about their backgrounds, internships for people with limited work experience, and training in occupations that offer more opportunities and open doors for ex-offenders. Success for those with prior criminal conviction ranges between 43 and 76% obtaining program, depending on the services and programs they engage in. We think that's good, but it could be a lot better if there were more open doors for this population. Research shows that between 60 and 75% of ex-offenders are jobless up to a year after release, and that personal interaction between the applicant and the prospective employer is a key factor in successful hiring. The approach of leading with strengths and giving job seekers a chance to communicate what they have to offer to an employer before they're screened out or need to talk about the checks against them is something that we support because we know what it means for the job seekers we assist in finding employment. I'd also add that for the many people who we serve who have a 10 or more year gap in their employment history, for them the barrier is bigger than a box. They often need career coaching, job training, and help connecting to employers. That's why I'm also here to support investments in employment services. That's an important part of the solution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much, for your testimony this morning. Up next, I have Tom Chamberlain, Midge Purcell, and Michelle. I'll leave it at Michelle. Good morning, and if you would introduce yourself before you give your testimony.
I thought you were. Okay.
I can flip the coin if you want.
A little leadership here. Good morning. My name's Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Men with criminal records account for about 33% of all non-working men between the ages of 25 and 54, according to the New York Times. This is our workforce, and this is the reality of the economy we live in today. As you've heard from previous panels, right now we know that workers with records are not being hired, not because they aren't trying or taking steps to improve themselves, but because too often the box on the application form is used as a screening tool. We have a choice as a state right now. We can choose to agree that after a person does their time in a correction institution, that their time is done. Or we can say that once a person has served their time, they need to continue to face barriers finding work, the most integral part of their life and identity. Too often these barriers last an entire lifetime, 20, 30 years after the crime has committed. This bill doesn't do a lot of things. It doesn't force an employer to do anything other than taking the box off and using and stopping using the box as a screening tool. It doesn't stop an employer from doing background checks. It doesn't force an employer to hire someone they don't want to hire. On behalf of the 300,000 working men and women of the Oregon AFL-CIO, we are here to urge your support for a fair chance for all and to support HB 3025. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland. And my job this morning is to explain the purpose behind the provisions in the bill and why we believe it will reduce barriers to employment for people who are trying to re-enter the workforce, earn a living, and make a positive contribution to their families and communities. HB 3025 merely rearranges the way that employers interview potential employees. Instead of asking questions about previous arrests or convictions at the beginning of the process, it is delayed until later in the hiring process. Asking a question about criminal history at the beginning of the hiring process reduces the pool of qualified applicants and often screens out candidates who may be the best fit for the job. HB 3025 allows applicants to present themselves and their qualifications as a whole package without being discriminated against at the outset. The bill in no way prevents an employer from asking about criminal backgrounds. This bill does not override any law that bars employment in certain occupations for individuals convicted of specific crimes. HB 3025 provides more clarity for both the employer and the applicant. For jobs that require a background check by law, the application form and position announcement must disclose that a background check is required. For a job that doesn't legally require a background check, but the employer has made a good faith determination that a background check is necessary, the job application and position announcement will disclose that job-related convictions will be considered. Both the employer and the employee will know the process and the requirements before any application is received. The law spells out the criteria for a good faith determination of job related by the employer, such as, is the conviction related to the job duties and responsibilities, and whether the job offers the ability or opportunity to reoffend. Applicants get to apply and present themselves as desirable employees. After the employer has narrowed the applicants and issued conditional offers, they can then run a background check or verbally inquire about an applicant's history. If an applicant's background check is cause for adverse action, meaning if the offer is withdrawn, the employer shall issue a letter to the applicant citing which elements of the background check were the cause of such an action, including a copy of the background check. The copy of the background check allows for the applicant to state whether or not the charge is correct. As companies have started selling this information, too often crimes listed are not what the applicant has been arrested for or convicted for. Finally, the applicant has 4 days to respond. In some cases, they may challenge the accuracy of the information, or they may provide evidence of rehabilitation. During this time, the employers must keep the position open to make a final decision until the applicant has had an opportunity to respond. After receiving the information, the employer must inform all applicants not being offered the position. They must be informed of the final decision. The applicant can appeal employment decision to BOLI under ORS 65-9A. Finally, I repeat, this is my second finally, it does not preclude an employer from doing a background check, nor does it dictate that an employer must hire anyone. What it does do is give an applicant a fair chance to make a good case why they are the right person for the job. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Michelle.
Sure. Hi. Thank you, Chair Hovey and committee members. Really appreciate all the time given to testimony today. My name is Michelle Natividad Rodriguez. You can just call me Michelle. I'm a senior staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project, and I'm really honored to testify in support of HB 3025 and applaud the work of the coalition. It's really been tremendous to see. To give you a little bit of background, NELP advocates for workers' rights, and we have been recognized as a leader in the national movement for fair chance hiring, which includes Ban the Box. I cannot even tell you. I keep track of all of the different policies, laws, ordinances all across the country, and we've had the opportunity to work with dozens of jurisdictions on this effort. So all of the issues that have been raised today, I'm very familiar with, and I'd be happy to engage with staff members and you personally on some of the issues that were raised. But to give you some of the national perspective, because really this is a national movement, and I think it's important to contextualize it. First, NELP estimates that there are 70 million adults with arrests or conviction records. Now, that's part of the reason this is so important. That number, it's staggering. I mean, that number really should give you a sense of, oh my gosh, there's one in three adults in the United States that are potentially dealing with this issue. And that's why we're here today, and that's why all across the country there's been such attention being put on this issue. With this bill, this state does have the opportunity to join what has been bipartisan efforts on smart on crime approaches. So that's really exciting. And beyond that, this has been tried and tested. This isn't a new policy at all. As I mentioned, we have worked with dozens of jurisdictions across the country, and this started in 1998. That's over 15 years ago, and that was Hawaii. And that particular policy, when it was adopted, it applied to private employers as well. And the threshold for inquiry into a criminal record was conditional offer. So sounds familiar with our bill today before us. Today, there are 14 states that have embraced this policy on a statewide level. That number is always changing. I heard someone mention 12 states before. That would have been accurate just a couple of months ago. But it's changing all the time because there's so many people that are jumping on this. And now there's over 100 local jurisdictions that have this policy as well. Adopted ordinances, policies. And at the federal level, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission officially recommended this policy as a best practice. And that was about ensuring that employers, all employers, are abiding by Title VII, so the anti-discrimination law in the employment context. This is a recommended practice to help align employers with that policy. So indeed, this really is a national movement. So to maximize the effectiveness of the policy, I really applaud the efforts of HB 3025 because I think it takes some of the best practices across the country. First of all, we're talking about private employer inclusion. And to be specific, that's been adopted, as I mentioned, in Hawaii, Illinois, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Private employer inclusion throughout the state, just as we're asking for here in Oregon. In addition to these six states, there's a dozen localities that have adopted the policy for private employers as well. And this particular legislation, it is consistent with our best practices that we've recommended for an effective policy. As I mentioned, the conditional offer threshold is a very important component of this. This does help in terms of ensuring that there's clarity for the hiring decision-making process and that there's a benefit to enforceability as well. And I also just want to cite some of the individuals that have spoken on this issue that really show this is a bipartisan effort. When Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey signed this legislation last year in terms of applying to private employers, he said, "This is going to make a huge difference for folks who have paid their debts to society." He believed in this issue. And when Governor Nathan Deal of Georgia issued his executive order just last month applying to the state, his state became a leader in the Deep South, and he recognized, quote, "This will enhance Georgia's reputation as the number one place in which to do business by increasing qualified applicant pools." So you see, he really saw this as about business as well. And it's hard not to imagine why conservative leaders in the nation, like Governor Christie and Governor Deal, why they support fair hiring. They make good sense, and we know that many private companies also agree, and that's why they've adopted fair hiring practices. Just to name a few, there's Target, there's Walmart, Home Depot, Bed Bath & Beyond. These are some of the national corporations that have adopted this policy. And I mentioned these corporations also to say, yes, there are leaders that are doing this voluntarily, but to the points that were made by Representative Barreto and Representative Esquivel earlier, and I congratulate both of you on your positive policies in terms of hiring people with records. That is to be commended. But unfortunately, not all employers are out there, and there are leaders on this, but frankly, it's by having a level playing field for employers, where employers can then say, well, I don't have to stand up and be the special one or the leader on this. I can just abide by the law, and we can all have the same playing field. And that way, employers then can adopt these policies and ensure that there is a fair chance for all. So thank you again for hearing me out, and I'm happy to answer questions, and hopefully I will get to meet with your offices as well.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, because it sounds like you've been involved with this for quite a while and everything. I guess, I mean, one of the places where I run into some of the issues and where we need this for, like, employers who are employing in-home health care for senior citizens, things like this. And I supported a bill that actually allowed us to that people who were convicted of felonies. It was over 5 years or 10 years. I can't remember what it was, but it was 4 years ago that we passed that. It actually hit home personally because I had a grandmother who we had an in-home caregiver who would come in and do cleaning for her. It was like once a week. And actually had her pain medicines were taken and they were supplemented with something else with the person that was coming in. And it was a big ordeal because you can't, they're a Schedule II drug, you can't go get these replaced. So here all of her pain medication's gone for a month for a 95-year-old woman. And it's because of policies like this that we put in place and banning the box, not allowing people who are hiring for that type of job or, say, child care, things like that. Do you think it's appropriate that we don't allow them to ask these questions?
So the types of jobs that you mentioned are the types of jobs that absolutely require background checks. There's a whole range of jobs. Dealing in healthcare, dealing with children, they're mandatory background checks at the federal and state level. And because they're mandatory background checks, that's going to happen. This law wouldn't change that. And that's something that is asked all across the country when this comes up. You know, what about these jobs that are dealing with vulnerable populations? And these policies are not meant to supersede that. That's not going to change, that the background checks are given.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a couple questions. One, what is the percentage of businesses in Oregon that do have a box? And then two, if it was just banning the box on the application, that would be fairly simple, and a bill seems like it would be very simple to write. However, this includes a lot more than that, and you spent three or four minutes just explaining all of the other requirements of the employer. So it's more than just ban the box, and I think it, in that sense, it has a little bit of a misconception to it.
Sure. I don't have the exact stats on the number of businesses that have the box, but typically, you know, the national stats show it's pretty high. And when we have we had a national survey that showed what was the likelihood of employers being impacted by seeing the information, and it was a drop in terms of job callbacks by 50%. It certainly does matter, and it's quite common to have the box. But to your second point, which I think is an important one, you know, it's very hard to kind of really capture all of the voices around the country around, you know, fair hiring. And in 3 minutes' time, very, very hard to get into the specifics of it. Ban the box as a policy, the simple removing the question from the job application, is the one that absolutely, as a bottom line for the 14 states and 100 jurisdictions, that they all have included that. But many of them have, as well, have included the components that are in this bill, too. And the reason for that is because it makes it a more effective policy. And I would also stress as well, It's not new. These are policies that have been implemented in other places. It's also the best practices under the EEOC guidance. I mean, this bill is actually consistent with that federal guidance in dealing with arrest and conviction records, to the specifics around how a conviction record is considered once it is looked at. You're looking at job relatedness, individual assessment, giving the person the opportunity to respond, getting a copy of the background check. It's actually consistent where we are on federal guidelines and federal laws. So again, it's not new ground.
Thank you. And Michelle, I think we could probably spend the rest of the morning asking you questions and listening to your answers, and I really appreciate that. And I hope that you'll be able to come back and have some more dialogue with our members as well, because I suspect we will have another opportunity on this bill in this hearing room. So if it pleases the committee, I'd like to move on with the testimony. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Up next, Betsy Earls, Jan Meekins, and J.L. Wilson.
This is a remarkably big deal. And it's dangerous territory. It's important territory.
So the questions threw us a little behind our three-minute goal, but hopefully you can keep us sort of online or on track. So, good morning, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm appearing today in opposition to House Bill 3025 as it's currently written. As it's written right now, 3025 simply lists a series of prohibitions on employers who are seeking to hire an employee who can not only effectively perform their job, but we're also looking for employees that can contribute positively to the work environment and, in many cases, to their professional communities. One very good way that employers can determine whether an applicant has these capabilities is to conduct a criminal background check in order to screen out employees with a history of behavior that's likely to detract from rather than contribute to the work and the mission of the potential employer. In prohibiting employer use of criminal background check information up to the point of a conditional job offer, which is the point that 3025 takes us to, unlike some other bills or laws around the country, the bill takes away that tool. This loss will impact employers in a variety of ways, and we can go through those in more detail another time, but let me just point out that the point that this bill takes you to, which is the point of the conditional offer of employment, requires an employer to provide quite a bit more individualized attention to every applicant, and that will be exceptionally burdensome in the case of larger employers that sometimes receive hundreds of applications for a single job. It'll slow down the hiring process and impede employers' ability to hire quickly in situations where they may need to do so. 3025 inserts some subjectivity into the hiring process because what one person determines to be job-related and important for a criminal background check may be very different from what another person determines is job-related. And it's not clear what types of rehabilitation examples an employer providing to a potential employee would be considered valid. For example, if we're hiring for a church and the employer is agnostic, do we have to accept that evidence? What kind of evidence do we have to accept as evidence of rehabilitation? I think if you look, and I'll submit this to all of you later, in its May 2014 report, which is called Collateral Damage, America's Failure to Forgive or Forget in the War on Crime, the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys makes several recommendations for addressing legal and social barriers that persist after a person has successfully completed their court-imposed sentence. And if you intend to go further with 3025, we recommend that you look at those recommendations. One of those that's very important to us is that the state consider affirmative incentives to offer opportunities to those with criminal records. We'd like to see meaningful tax credits for hiring those with criminal records, potentially free bonding to provide insurance to any employers who are hiring employees with a criminal background record. And we'd like to see some eligibility for immunity for employers that are considering hiring or that do hire somebody with a criminal background record to protect them from negligent hiring claims. So far, unfortunately, 3025 doesn't make any effort in the direction of the employer who will be considering hiring somebody with this criminal background history, and we very much urge you to consider those protections as you move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson. I'm representing the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce, the National Northwest Food Processors Association, Oregon Metals. I think there's a common thread among all of us, which I think we all can get to a place where we support banning the actual box on the employment application. I think, for the most part, we're all there. The issue is that House Bill 3025 goes far beyond that. And the point that I want to bring up, in me as an employer, and I've alluded to this, I've got about 30 employees, that I owe it to my employees, I owe it to my customers, I owe it to the public, that they have a reasonable expectation that the people I hire will not subject them to harm or any unwanted activity. I, as an employer, am legally liable for my workplace and the actions of my employees in many cases. And I want to bring up a couple things that impact me as an employer and my clients. The vast majority of my workforce is female. We work in close quarters and sometimes strange and odd hours. I am going to run background checks for the safety of my employees, particularly my female employees, that the people that I introduce into the workplace, I can have assurance will be conducive to a constructive workplace and that my employees are free of any threat of harm or harassment or anything, because I, as an employer, am liable for that. And I think that that's important. And this bill calls into question whether the things that I might preclude a job applicant from having a job at my company, whether those are job-related. And, you know, is harassment job-related? Is domestic violence job-related? You can make an argument that those things aren't job-related, yet they have an impact on the very people I'm legally responsible for in my workplace. And, again, those are predominantly female employees. You have a number of manufacturers that have adopted workplace drug-free policies. They have zero-tolerance policies. Under this legislation, I could easily foresee that an employer would be compelled to hire someone with drug convictions, drug history, criminal background, and that, right, that might compromise those safety policies, and or at least are not conducive with those policies, because you could argue that criminal history is not consistent with being job-related, and I think that's a bad outcome. You talk about the things that I have been in this committee in front of, talking about protections for domestic violence victims, victims of sexual harassment, stalking, sexual assault, and employers are expected, in fact, legally expected, to offer time off, accommodation in the workplace, and yet we're going to be put in a position with 3025 that we might not be able to consider the criminal histories in those arenas when we hire people on, because those might not be considered job-related. And so those are some of the outcomes that I think that 3025 introduces, when all I think we're really talking about here is banning the box, which I think is a reasonable expectation and a place that we could get to. You know, criminal history with regard to multiple convictions calls into questions patterns of behavior that employers might not want in the workplace, and yet they might not be job-related. I think BOLI has enormous liability under this bill. Imagine if I deny somebody the ability to work because I make a determination based on a criminal history that my employees are not safe with them in the workplace, and yet they have the ability to appeal to BOLI, and BOLI could supersede my judgment. Now, what happens if that employee does, in fact, cause a problem in the workplace, which I am liable for? You better believe BOLI's going to be liable. And I guess the last point that I'd wrap up with is, or why are some employers worthy of mandatory background checks and others not? I mean, I would not fall under the mandatory check. Are my workplace dynamics less important? Are my employees less important? Are my customers less important than the folks that are subject to mandatory checks? So all of these things, 3025 calls into question. When I think what we're talking about is banning the box, and we could all get there. But 3025 opens up a whole host of issues that we would be opposed to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director of NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business. We're an association of 7,000 individual privately owned businesses in the state of Oregon, 350,000 nationwide, and we are strongly opposed to 3025 as it is written. We also agree with the solution of banning the box, and we could get there as well. We agree that people can change. We agree that people deserve a second chance. And most of our employers would be willing to give that second chance under a proper circumstances. We don't feel that 3025 creates those proper circumstances. Our opposition mainly is in the area of liability. We appreciate the goal, but what this bill, as it's written, does is create a lot of exposure, and that it would be preferable for the state to use a carrot and not a club to entice employers to hire felons, someone with a conviction record. And if you look at the definition of felon, it's serious crimes. It can be anything from a drug conviction to rape to murder. And there's no differentiation or distinction in this bill that's provided to the employer to necessarily make that process. And if they do decide not to hire after the initial letter, the process the process that the employer has to go through is quite extraordinary, especially for a small employer. Most of our employers have less than 10 employees, and it says that in the bill that they would have to withhold hiring until this was resolved. So you could have a small employer that has a critical position to fill, and they get caught up in this circumstances of this bill, and then they're left without an employee until it gets resolved. And it also appears that it creates a protected class, a new protected class, and gives the convicted felon more rights than someone in the workplace or the employer who's trying to protect that workplace. We find that a significant problem with this bill. So that would be, we are in agreement what has been said before, and those are added notes, and we would love to be at the table to work out a solution to open the door to these people that truly do deserve a second chance in the workplace.
Any brief questions, comments for this panel? Vice Chair Kinnemer.
Thank you. Ms. Meekums, you alluded to a protected class.
Yes.
And that's a question I've been having. And can you explain some of the implications of protected class and why you think this might rise to that level?
Yeah. I am not an attorney,
okay,
and I would probably defer to an employment attorney to address that specifically. Mm-hmm. But the way it lays out with the convicted felon, the rights that they're given and the due process that they are given within this bill, it seems that it does construct them into a type of protected class in this environment. You may have something that you could elaborate on that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kinnemer. I think the issue is that you can't, under the bill, take adverse employment actions based on a criminal history, which under 659A is protections for the protected classes, and they have, in some case, what I would consider sort of an elevated right of being able to appeal to BOLI the employment decision of the employer if it resulted in not having a hire. And so it certainly does have the appearance of elevating that class of potential employee.
Thank you. Any other questions to this panel? Briefly? No. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Next up will be Lana Butterfield, Roger Beyer, and Rob Bovet, please.
Thank you.
welcome to go in any order.
Go ahead.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I lobby for several small groups of small employers, and I absolutely love working for these small independent business people. Two of them have concerns about this bill or these bills. The first group is the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon/Idaho, and the other group is the Pacific Propane Gas Association. Both of these groups are mandated by law not to allow certain people to work for them because of conviction for crimes. Under insurance agents, if you look on the paper that I've given you under C, it says whether the applicant has ever been convicted of or is under indictment for a crime, whether the applicant has ever had a judgment entered against the applicant for fraud, and et cetera. Under the propane dealers, they're hiring people to drive around these big trucks full of a flammable, hazardous substance. And I know that the FBI has concerns about somebody driving into the White House with, you know, a big loaded bomb, so on and so forth. And there are other reasons, as I've given you, that are not allowed, that they are not allowed to hire people who have been convicted of other kinds of crimes. So for a small independent business, wouldn't it be more fair to exempt them from people who are, you know, mandated not to be hired under certain licenses, to somehow exempt a very small business from this law, so that they don't have to go through the tortuous process of of hiring somebody first and then doing a background check? If they saw on the application that they couldn't hire this person anyway, then that's more fair. So that's our concerns, and I will turn it over to Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here today representing the Independent Agents and Brokers of Oregon and the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. As Lana said, these professions have prohibitions of hiring people with certain criminal backgrounds. It's very common in the insurance world, especially the independent agent world, that they bring an employee into the practice before they are a licensed insurance producer, and they start to train them, and the people will work for them in a certain capacity in the office as they're trying to obtain their insurance license. So to bring someone in who is unable by law or not allowed by law to be able to be an insurance producer and invest that sort of time, money, and training into that individual, and then have to find out they are prohibited by law from being able to do the job you've hired them to do, doesn't make a lot of sense. So as Lana said, you know, we believe that there at least are certain jobs or certain occupations that need to be able to ask the questions before jobs are offered, because those people are in fact prohibited from doing those jobs, and therefore we would appreciate your, you know, attention to that matter, and at least a carve out or something for those occupations. Mr. Chair, happy to answer your questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovette, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I thought in 3 minutes or less I'll bring up three issues that I don't think you've heard yet. First is we have some concerns about the application of this bill in the law enforcement arena. It's already a very lengthy process to hire a law enforcement officer, and to be asking about criminal records at the end of the process is probably not helpful to either potential employees or employers. Just put that into consideration. I'm sure you'll hear more from law enforcement partners on that issue. Really, I want to talk about two other issues. First, the way the bill is written technically right now, actually both bills, an employer cannot consider convictions for infractions. Counties and other local governments provide lots of direct public services. One example is we provide drivers for lots of folks that need driving services, you can imagine. We could have someone apply that has a lengthy and recent conviction history of speeding tickets, careless driving. Not only would these bills not allow us to consider those up front, they would prohibit us from considering those at the end of the process as well, just a categorical prohibition. So it doesn't make any sense to us. I think the public would be rather shocked if we essentially were forced to hire people with really lengthy, really bad driving records to be a driver for public services. Finally, there is what I perceive to be a potential technical glitch in the bill, and just in the interest of being open and upfront and honest with both of these bills, as I've always done in the past 20 years in this building, there is a technical reading of this bill that both these bills that may make them non-applicable to all public bodies. And let me just sketch that for you very briefly. Right now, the bill defines employer. Both bills don't define employer to include public bodies. However, both definitions do include the term person. Person is defined in ORS Chapter 659A and 659A010 to include public bodies. But there is no add clause in either of these bills. Neither of these bills adds the substantive provisions to ORS 659A. Thus, you default to the LC statutes, as I call them, ORS 174.100, which defines person, which does not include a public body, but does have an unless the context requires otherwise clause, and there is extensive case law interpreting that. So the bottom line is if you don't fix that provision, we're going to litigate whether it applies to public bodies, including the state, counties, cities, and everybody else. So I just call that to your attention because it is a if you intended to not apply these bills to public bodies, thank you very much. But I suspect that may not have been your intent.
Okay. Thank you very much for your constructive testimony. Appreciate it this morning. Up next, I have Mick Fleming, Lucinda Hiles, Khalil Edwards, and has Emmanuel Price here. So, and if you can keep your testimony brief and not repeat what's already been said, if you know what's already been said. Otherwise, introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Emmanuel Price. Should I start?
Just go ahead.
All right, I'm going to pull up my testimony really quick. A quick minute. So my name is Emmanuel Price. I'm the founder of SCAFE. SCAFE is a nonprofit organization I founded a few years ago. It's an acronym. It stands for Second Chances Are for Everyone. And I was incarcerated at age 19 after finishing my sophomore year at Virginia Union University in Richmond, Virginia. I had been sentenced to 4.5 years to an Oregon Correctional Facility for a Class A felony. Transitioning from a full-time college student in Virginia to a full-time prisoner in Oregon, I was incarcerated. And this was more than I'd ever envisioned for myself. So it was a new time for myself and my family, being that none of us had any felony backgrounds or had any interactions with the criminal justice system. I don't really have to read this. I can kind of just speak from what I know. So as I was locked up in Oregon Correctional Facilities, like I said, I went from a full-time college student to a full-time prisoner, spent 4.5 years in Oregon Correctional Facilities. And as I was transitioning out into society, I went through several programs trying to reacclimate myself into society, went back to school, continuing my education, looking for several jobs. And I found that every job that I would get or every job that I didn't get boiled down to that question on the application. And I was very transparent about my felony background and my past. But it seems sometimes I would either get to the third and fourth interview and they would look down at that question and I would be immediately discarded. Or I would oftentimes fill out applications for jobs or housing, and as soon as I turned my application in, I could read the body language and I could see the look on their face. I knew that I would not either, one, get that job or get that apartment. And that kind of just repeated itself for, you know, 10 years over. I'm now 37. I've been out 12 years. When I committed my crime, like I said, I was 19. And just even most recently, I was hired to work with, to do conflict resolution in Portland Public Schools. And we had a contract, or I work for a different agency, but they have a contract with PPS. So, of course, I filled out the application. I was very transparent, spoke about my background. And usually when I address that question or answer that question, I say I lead with I was 19 at the time. I did 4 years in Multnomah County, and I am now 37, to give the employee a chance to look at that and say, okay, I can see he's an adult man, and this happened over 19 years ago. But specifically in this incident, I was hired, and they ran the background check about a month after I was hired to work in the school district. Now, conflict resolution is basically giving kids a way to dialogue and work through their problems instead of us punitively punishing them and reducing suspensions and expulsions over 50%, handed down by Carol Smith, the superintendent. And primarily to work specifically with black and brown boys because they have a high suspension and expulsion rate over the past several years, but also to work with the teachers to give them additional tools to work so we can reduce that. So that's the conflict resolution work that I do. 1 month into the school year, I was fired because they ran the background check late. About 3 weeks after that, I was rehired. A week after that, I was fired. 2 weeks after that, I was rehired. So the story goes, I was hired, fired, rehired, fired, and rehired again. My last rehire was late November, so I've been back into the school system about a little under 6 months. But in the very beginning, I was very transparent about my background, and even though this crime was 19 years in my past, it still haunts me to this very day. So I know that banning the box, you know, would help increase the chances for people to work. It would also increase chances for employers to give those folks a second chance. Now, had I not been transparent about my background, the same thing would have happened. And as I was going through this hiring and firing and hiring and firing, I met with one of the lead background check persons at PPS, and he told me, your application shouldn't have been made to pass the receptionist's desk. So he then had to go and talk to the receptionist and chew her ear off about her not screening, you know, and taking the right protocol. But being that it did make it past the receptionist's desk and I was hired to do this specific work, and then I went through the hiring and firing, it was just another testament to myself, like, society is still holding this felony over my head, even though I work in the nonprofit world and I work with kids and I've created a nonprofit and I have had all these successes since I've been out. It was still hard for me to let, or still hard for society to let that go. So I'm a single father. I'm a grown man. I know grown men older than me who also are looking for work, who have had some of the same exact barriers, who are 50 and 60, who live with their parents. And what grown man wants to live with his parents unless you are taking care of your parents? Fortunately, I've had good relationships with people in my community and my family that help me overcome some of these barriers. But I know this is not the end all ban in the box, but it's a step in the right direction. And I get that employers will be a little bit apprehensive. Of course, we all have our norms and stereotypes of what a felon is and what these people do. But we also have to extend that olive branch and make sure that we're giving people an opportunity, because I myself am still continually struggling with the same thing, even though I am working now. When the school year ends, I will have to refill out another background check. God forbid I have to go through the same hiring and firing and hiring and firing. Nobody wants to do that. So in closing, I appreciate the time, and I would really take your advice, but also listen to us and take our advice and really weigh on that. You have employers here, you have people who are working, you have, you know, this is not just a statistical number. These are people's lives, these are people's businesses that are affected by something like this, and I support it because I am affected by it every day.
Thank you. And if you could try to keep it short, I would appreciate it.
Well, I think it was important for you to hear what he said.
It was extremely.
And likewise, I'm another case that may take some consideration. In October of 2014, the Innocence Project finally
Introduce
started.
Introduce yourself for the record,
I'm sorry.
Please.
I apologize. My name...
Move that mic back away from you a little bit.
Okay.
It's very sensitive.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. Mm. I am from Forest Grove, Oregon. And I spent 756 days in prison, wrongfully accused, falsely accused, now finally acknowledged on the record. But I was falsely accused, wrongfully convicted, and spent time in prison. Did keep praying, and I finally did win my appeal. The conviction was reversed. I am now on record as being a wrongfully convicted person who had been falsely accused. But I do have a conviction on a record now, even though legally that should not exist. And so I want to bring to your attention that the Innocence Project, which just got started in Oregon, October 2014, and immediately was deluged by over 100 cases of people who are in prison claiming that they are cases of actual innocence and need help to get released. I didn't get their help. I had to do it through friends and people who knew I was innocent, through churches. But there are going to be more people coming like me. So what I'm going to tell you is not an anomaly. You are going to be faced with even more people like me, and you will need to consider how you want to put that and codify information about that into law. Because there is prosecutorial misconduct taking place in this state, DAs, DDAs are committing prosecutorial misconduct at a terrible, terrible rate, and it will have to be addressed in other bills, but it is going to be the cause of, and you will see the effects of, a lot of people, such as myself. When there was overcharging, hypercriminalization, and overzealous action on the part of DAs and DDAs to criminalize, and that the common practice has not been to search for truth, but to convict, you will have people such as myself coming to you who have served time, need to get their records cleared, need to have their lives restored and brought back. And you don't even have a compensation law right now in Oregon, by the way. One of the few in the country that doesn't, for people who have been wrongfully convicted. We'll address that in another bill, too. But you're going to see people such as myself, and they may be at some point need to be looked at as a protected class. This is another thought to investigate. Meanwhile, what happened to me when I won my appeal and the conviction was reversed July 18th of 2012. Immediately, there should have been removal of my name. That conviction should not have been seen to have existed any longer. And immediately, the state police, through the LEDS system, law enforcement data system, should have removed my name. That connection also then would have connected me to have removal from FBI and Interpol records. And any other kind of lists or wrongful misrepresentations of who I am and what I did not do, all of that should have been reversed and removed immediately. The appeals court decisions should have been sent immediately to LEDS and to those other entities. And immediate action should be taken, and that needs to be put into law. Please. Okay? So the next piece is, how are the background checks being performed and by whom? Because it makes a difference. I believe that legally, all background checks should be performed exclusively by the Oregon State Police and the LEDS system. They should not be allowed to be done by private companies and little internet sites where information and misinformation is in abundance. And so if the common small businessman wants to do a background check, he'd better do it right by going through the state system, because everything should be removed properly through the lead system. And if you go on the internet and just do a background check and Google me, that's not okay, because all kinds of things will come up. And a person can go, I could go to the FCC, I could go through a 6.5-year process to be angry about what internet people are saying about me wrongfully still. But it would take that long for me to get that internet site removed and fined and everything off. And then there'll be another site that pops up instead in its place. So I would say that we do need to put into law that only going through the state system and the state police-led system is appropriate. I probably hit 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any questions, though? I could go on.
Yeah,
but
we appreciate that you're not going on. And though I do appreciate your testimony, it's very important for us to hear, you know, how Ban the Box could potentially impact you, albeit unfair, it seems. You know, the background check issue is a little bit off of this bill, but it still is an important issue. So I thank you for your testimony. I really would like to move on.
Do support 3025. I have not had the opportunity to read 3097. I didn't know it existed before I came today. I came only knowing about 3025. I would like to be able to speak at a later date on 3097. And I also would be happy to be a resource person when you do some work groups and mark up things and create amendments. I would really appreciate having some information and feedback from people here and to work with people so that people who are innocent
can follow the amendments on our website. If you have that capability on the OLIS website, the amendments get posted, and you can send emails directly to any of us here with your feedback on that. So I really appreciate your testimony.
Okay. And I will do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, honorable members, my name is Mick Fleming. I am a director of PERMA, the Portland Human Resource Managers Association. It's a professional association of about 900 members. I'm here in favor of banning the box, HB 3025. I don't promise to not repeat, but I will promise to be short. For the last year, I've been a leader on a committee to develop a training program through Mercy Corps to provide assistance to second chance persons with resumes, applications, and interviews. And I can assure you the box is a major item of conversation, anxiety, and unnecessary concern. I've listened to the arguments against, and some of the thought processes that were presented to you, it seems to me, are exactly the kind of things we would hope every employer would consider in making these decisions. And I think that the bill won't cure this poor woman's situation, but it would give her a chance to explain it and to get a fair chance at a hearing based on her side of the view. And I would hope that the bill could find also the right language to exempt and simplify those situations of statutory exclusion. I'm not at all interested in producing a protected class with a lot of red tape in the bill, but I think that can be arrived at, and I think the bill's very close to it. I have 3 points, but I think it's a good thing for the community to do everything possible for us to enable a smooth reentry to those among us who have paid the penalty and are ready and willing to be productive in society. I think it's a good thing for an employer to hire the best, secure in the knowledge that the candidate will make a positive contribution to the enterprise. As a professional working in reentry, I support the bill because it ensures an honest second chance to be fairly considered. And as a recruiter for employers, I support the bill because it doesn't prevent my clients from considering all aspects of a candidate's background, but just at the appropriate moment. As a taxpayer, I certainly support getting as many ex-offenders back into the workforce as quickly as possible. This is my first visit to the Capitol. I was struck when I came in at all the mandatory civic language of the 30s that's engraved on the on the building. It was probably a civic convention at the time. But as soon as you step up to the door, we hear the word righteousness, and as soon as you go through the door, you read again righteousness. I think this is a good and righteous bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey, members of the committee.
I hope it's not afternoon, but it seems
Oh,
like
good morning. Good morning. My name is Khalil Edwards. I'm the director of PFLAG, Portland Black Chapter. I also work at Basic Rights Oregon, who has provided written testimony in support of House Bill 3025 and strongly supports passage of this bill. And thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony on this important issue. I will try to be brief. PFLAG Portland Black Chapter provides support, education, advocacy, and resources for black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and allied communities. We represent an important and significant part of Portland. We support and urge you to pass House Bill 3025 that will remove barriers for countless black LGBTQ people, specifically youth and young adults and thousands more throughout the state of Oregon. The culture of homophobia, anti-gay violence, transphobia, ignorance, and lack of acceptance too often push black and brown, gay, and transgender people into a cycle of homelessness, unemployment, and sometimes leads to crimes of survival. Our groundbreaking 2012 Lift Every Voice report, created in partnership with the Urban League of Portland, highlights the experiences and disparities impacting black LGBTQ Oregonians. The report quantifies our concerns and what we know about our LGBTQ community. We are still disproportioned. There was a startling rate of 18% unemployment in our community, and an estimated 42 of homeless LGBTQ youth of color. In fact, every highlighted issue area that the report focused on, looking at the disparities we face, the numbers are even higher than our straight black counterparts and white LGBTQ counterparts. I've heard countless of stories of folks that are part of the communities that we serve who struggle with landing employment due to their criminal background. And I'm sure you all have heard countless stories as well around this issue and how it impacts folks. This is an opportunity to change that, to give individuals who have paid their debt to society a chance to start over and thrive without their criminal history being used against them. We know how important removing barriers are to members of the black LGBTQ community, so it's imperative that we create those opportunities and policies that will remove barriers for equal opportunities. Passing House Bill 3025 and banning the box will allow individuals with a criminal history a better chance to be considered a viable candidate without being prejudged by the check in the box. Now is the time to ban the box, and we as PFLAG Portland Black Chapter urge you to pass this bill and show that we matter, that we are part of this community, and that the state of Oregon is supportive of and invested in the success of our black LGBTQ community. And, you know, hearing a lot what has been said, I really think that this is about a culture of fear and a narrative that tells us, that does not separate the crime from the person and does not look at the conditions of what, often the conditions that can lead to criminal acts. And, you know, states around the country have shown that, you know, that we need to look at fairness and creating opportunities for folks. And I think that it's time that Oregon follows that, because that's what we're about at this state, too. And so we need to be in line with that fairness and creating opportunities for folks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate everybody's patience in trying to get their testimony on the record. I'm sure we'll have more conversations about this bill as we move through the process. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3097.
And
close the public hearing on House Bill 3025. With that, committee, we're going to stand at ease for just a couple of minutes before we get into House Bill 2960. Don't.
Yeah, so, yeah, that makes me feel really good.
Yeah.
Like, could you go ahead and move your conversations outside, please? Thank you. I'd like to reconvene the Committee on Business and Labor, and I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2960. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. You've heard probably more than enough from me and others on the concept of retirement security, so I don't intend to talk about that again. I thought I would come and just briefly introduce the Dash 6 amendments, which are our...
And before you get started, I know it's short. Jan, can you just refresh the committee's memory on House Bill 2960?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the measure that creates the Oregon Retirement Savings Board that would be chaired by the treasurer.
Good enough, great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We saw Tobias and knew it right away.
So, you're here to briefly give us the -6 amendment, I believe. So
yes, sir.
Go ahead. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a variety of technical things that are probably not worth great detailed conversation unless you want to talk about them, in which case we certainly can. I wanted to highlight two more substantive changes in the -6s. The first, wanted to really acknowledge the success of the 529 College Savings Plan and the way that it operates. In order to do that, we've changed our structure such that an employer would send an employee's contributions directly to the plan and the third-party administrator that the board contracts with. It makes sure that those contributions start earning interest more quickly and ensures that the state doesn't have any liability in that withholding process. The second is that we've taken a little bit different approach in giving state agencies that are involved the timeline and specific funding to come up with a plan for outreach to Oregonians and employers to educate them about the plan. We think that helps ensure that the employers who are covered comply and that Oregonians are given a chance to choose whether they want to participate or not. So those are the two significant substantive changes, both intended to make the plan operate more efficiently and effectively. And I commend the -6 amendments to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that on the -6 amendment. Is there questions? Representative Reed on the -6 amendment? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for giving us that overview of the -6. I appreciate that. Representative Widener, would you like to give us a brief description of your -7?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
We all have it on OLIS members.
OLIS, I have hard copies as well if members of the committee would like hard copies as well here.
Go ahead and start, Representative Widener. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, a lot of these issues came up that we were dealing with in the committee. I had a town hall, reached out and talked with a lot of local businesses in my community, a lot of employees. In my community as well, restaurant industries, also insurance companies, different places, and kind of came up with the idea of an Oregon sick time and retirement savings program. And essentially is what these amendments do is allow the employee to take 3%, well, it sets it with a cap of 5% for a board to come up with an amount that the employee can contribute into a fund. And I actually got a chance to talk with the treasurer about this yesterday, and he was intrigued by the concept or the idea. But the money will go into a fund that is managed by the treasurer, but you become sick at work and you're off for a couple days. You just go to the employment office, so you file a claim, and then the employment office would pay you. If you don't ever touch this money, say, you know, I'm healthy, go through my work schedule and everything all the time, and I never really take any time off for work, or I never draw the funds, and at 50 I come down with cancer, I could have up to $300,000 in this account where I say to my employer, you know what, I'm going to take a leave of absence, I'm going to take a year off from work so I can battle this cancer. And you have enough money that you would draw in the employment office. They would just issue your checks for the time that you're off and everything at that point. If you don't touch it at all, and you get to the age of 65, then, or 62, you could draw the whole amount out and use it actually as to supplement your Social Security. This would not interfere with any 401k that you have through your work, but this also offers smaller employers that can't afford or don't have the time to mess with 401k to do something for their employees or offer it to them. So that's essentially how the -7 works. I think it's safe to say that business and industry supports my amendments.
Thank you.
One question.
I, Representative Doherty.
Okay, so in other words, I'm paying for my sick leave. I have to put my money in for a sick leave bank.
Yeah, it follows you wherever you go. So
No, my question is, so I, as an employee, pay into the sick leave bank?
Yes, it is your money, it is your fund, it follows you, and it actually supplements your Social Security.
You've answered my question, thank you.
Yeah. And did you check with Legislative Council to see if this amendment actually fits into the relating to clause of the bill?
Legislative Council said yes, it does fit into the relating to clause of the bill. The place where we ran into was the sick leave side. There were some changes I had to make for it to fit into the sick leave where we changed it. The reason I thought it fit better here with this bill is because we wanted to take advantage of some of the federal tax benefits for using it in the retirement side.
Okay.
And that's why we ran it to this bill.
Okay. Representative Esquivel, would you like to discuss the Dash 3 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that very much. The Dash 3 amendments that you have on OLIS does several things. First of all, it makes the board, requires the board to conduct a feasibility analysis showing that the plan proposed by the board would be fiscally self-sustaining and not require any general fund subsidy. The bill currently only requires a vague feasibility study. The legislature should understand and estimate the cost of the programs before we proceed. Second thing it would do would be obtain an opinion from the IRS confirming that the savings vehicles and the proposed plan will receive favorable tax treatment. The IRA-like arrangement proposed by the Treasurer is untested and has never been approved by the IRS or implemented in any other state of the union. The 650,000 Oregonians automatically enrolled in this plan deserve to know whether they will receive any tax benefits at all. The third thing, it obtains an advisory opinion from the U.S. Department of Labor indicating that the plan proposed under the by the board will not expose the state of Oregon or participating employers to liabilities or responsibilities under ERISA. If the state mandate conflicts with federal law or the plan is subject to ERISA, which is likely, it may mean huge costs and risks and liabilities for the state and participating employers. The fourth thing it does, it requires the board to submit a plan to the legislature for review, fiscal analysis, and approval. For a plan covering 650,000 Oregonians, it would be more of a mandate to participate under Cover Oregon. Wouldn't it be prudent for us as a legislature to see the plan, understand the plan, and improve the plan?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just make a personal comment. Originally, I was a sponsor of the bill, and I have withdrawn that. And also, there was an article yesterday that said that, and they are now corrected. So I just want to put that on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Barton.
Chair Holvey, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2960.
Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2960. Discussion? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to briefly make a comment for purposes of legislative history with respect to the auto-enroll feature and its severability in relation to the larger bill. I'm fairly confident. This bill is obviously designed to fall within the safe harbor IRA provisions of ERISA. I'm confident we have done that based on everything we can do. The one only question mark, the only doubt in my mind at all, would be whether the auto-enroll feature complies with the voluntariness prong of the safe harbor requirements. My understanding is the Department of Labor reg suggests that we are okay doing that. However, in the event the district court or the Ninth Circuit or some other jurisdiction or court rules that the auto-enroll feature does infringe on the voluntariness prong, that doesn't throw out the entire program. It'll simply be turned into an opt-in feature. And we looked specifically into whether or not we should put in a severability clause that would specifically state that. However, LC indicated to us that it is not necessary because the severability clause is assumed in Oregon law. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Other discussion on the Dash 6 amendment? Not seeing any. I assume there might be objection to Representative Barreto.
Can we have a little recess just to visit? Is that acceptable?
Yes, a few minutes. We'll stand at ease.
Thank you.
Like to reconvene the Committee on the House House Business and Labor, and we are under a work session on House Bill 2960. We have an amendment, motion to adopt the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 2960. We've had discussion, and Matthew, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto?
No.
Representative Dougherty?
Yes.
Representative Escobar?
No.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative
Nose? Absolutely.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gunman?
No.
Chair Oldie?
Aye. The Dash 6 Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Widener?
I move that we adopt the Dash 7 Amendment to House Bill 2960.
Representative Widener moves the adoption of the Dash 7 Amendment to House Bill 2960. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, as I said earlier, I think this is a better vehicle for moving this type of plan, and I would hope the committee would see things the same way and we would adopt this amendment.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be voting against this amendment, but I did want to compliment Representative Widener on really some creative legislating, really thinking outside the box. We've talked a lot about these issues. He was trying to find a vehicle to do it, and I'm happy to continue working with him on similar proposals in future sessions, but I'll be voting no today.
Thank you. Other discussion? Not seeing any. Matthew, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Dougherty?
No.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
No.
Representative
Fagan? No.
Representative
Hurd?
Aye.
Representative
Nose? No.
Representative
Weider? Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
Nope.
Aye.
Chair
Holby? No. The Dash 7 Amendment has failed. Representative Kinnemer.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 3 Amendments, please.
Representative Kinnemer moves to adopt the Dash 3 Amendments to House Bill 2960. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think I've outlined what this amendment does, so therefore it brings in a little more transparency and it lets us have some time to analyze exactly what we're jumping into.
Appreciate that. Other discussion? And I do appreciate this amendment too. I think it's well thought out. I do worry that we wouldn't get feedback, from the U.S. Department of Labor, and in terms of whether it complies with ERISA, I don't know that they've done that sort of acknowledgement in the past, to give us that prospectively. So I appreciate that. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with respect to Representative Escobar, my friend, I will be voting no on this amendment. I think the ERISA issues have been worked out as thoroughly as they can at this point, and I feel, again, there's that one issue of the voluntariness prong, but given that it's severable, I feel that we're in good stead to move forward. Accordingly, I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other comments? Matthew?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Dougherty?
No.
Representative Escobar?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
No.
Representative Fagan?
No.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative
Nose?
No.
Representative
Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Martin?
No.
Vice Chair Kenneman?
Aye.
Chair Holbit?
No. The Dash 3 amendments, not having received the votes, has failed.
Mr. Chair, if I could just like to serve notice of possible minority report or two.
Okay. I'm not sure that the motion's in order, but we'll go ahead and
move
do
it to the floor first.
Maybe that's a better.
Never mind.
I'm curious to see
the. Goes to waste. Okay.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2960 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barton has moved House Bill 2960 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Kenemer. Yeah.
Let's go back. I guess, again, you know, it may not stay in Ways and Means. There are lots of things that can happen, so I'd like to still serve notice that we, if there is an opportunity, we would like to have a minority report or two.
Duly noted. I think if the bill were to come back into another committee and at a future time, that that would be the appropriate time to serve notice of a minority report. I don't think our rules allow us to put minority reports on bills that are being referred to other committees.
That's my understanding, but so. You never know when circumstances change. Could be pulled to the floor or any number of other.
Yeah. Well, short of us changing the rules between now and the time this gavel goes down. Anyway, it's on the record. So.
Thank you. I think Representative Whitener.
Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope as this bill makes its way to Ways and Means that. I know the treasurer has the Dash 7 amendments. I hope they have a chance to look at those and gain more support in the Ways and Means process. We do have the business community that's very intrigued by this proposal that I brought forward. I reached out to a lot of different people with it. I think it's something that answers a lot of the questions, because the problem I see with the 401k is lots of people let the money build up. They get in trouble with debt, and they will go and withdraw all that money at one time to take care of debt, and then they find themselves in the situation again after they've given up all their tax advantages, where this will only allow them to draw the money if they're sick and they're taking time off for an illness or something like that. So it actually helps them accumulate and not withdraw the money at once, and it'll supplement Social Security, and I can see this changing. I mean, actually, this country, if we all started developing this type of process for people, and it's something that people would start talking to each other about and say, right. Hey, I got $50,000, $200,000 in my sick.
I appreciate your comments and certainly your thinking outside the box. I'm still supportive of this bill that's been well vetted and worked on for several years, and comfortable moving this forward. So, Matthew, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Barretta?
No.
Representative Estabrook? No. Representative Evans? Yes. Representative Fagan? Yes. Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nelson? Aye. Representative Whitener? No. Vice Chair Barton? Aye. Vice Chair Turner? No. Chair Holvey? Aye. House
Bill 2960, having received the votes, is passed on to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2960. And Jan, anything else on our agenda? We do have House Bill 2005 work session scheduled for today. That will be carried over to Monday, the 30th.
And there are many amendments that have come in, and I think by now they are all on OLAS, but if any further amendments are received, we'll post them on OLAS immediately.
So certainly, committee, in your leisure over the week, three-day weekend, you might try to get through some of those amendments. So,
read up.
And that concludes everything. I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Committee on Business and Labor.